We had no alternative to set a course for Echo 3, where someday this vessel, eventually this log, will be found. May God have mercy on our souls.
Why don't you cut the crap and get back here and help me?
Welcome, everyone. Matt here, and welcome to Star Trek Essentials. Our voyage each week, review the very best of the first 50 years of the Star Trek franchise. Joining me as always is Pete. Hello, Pete.
Hey, Matt. Hey, everybody. I'm here, but I'm always hoping that the next leap will take me home.
Indeed. Maybe we'll something to think about for the upcoming Quantum Leap Essentials podcast. Coming never. Anyhow, today we're talking about the Star Trek Enterprise episode, Shuttle Pod 1. Pete, for the uninitiated, give us a little background on Star Trek Enterprise, or as the cool kids call it, Enterprise.
Yes, Enterprise, as it was known for much of its early run. It was an attempt by UPN to distance itself from the Star Trek brand, at the same time keep everything about the Star Trek brand. So in the long and storied history of Hollywood, it was basically another bad decision. But I digress. Star Trek Enterprise, will proudly proclaim it, is the seventh and last series that has run bearing the name Star Trek to this point in 2013. It debuted very shortly after September 11th, 2001. UPN had finished up the seven-season run of Voyager and very hastily was looking for what would fill the spot. They settled in that they wanted to remain with Star Trek and with Paramount, and the rumors of a prequel quickly surfaced, and then things got out of control. And all sorts of rumors, you know, were, are we going to get Teen Kirk and Teen Spock? What's going to happen here? And then we hear it's about a vessel called Enterprise, and people's interests were piqued, only to find out it was an Enterprise that predates the Enterprise we already knew. So there was some problems canonically there, and fans were very much concerned. And then the rumors about the theme song began to spread, much like a virus or a toxin, if you will, bringing with it nothing but distaste and death.
Wow.
That they wanted to shake things up at the same time, again, maintain what they had, which makes very little sense. They decided they would go with a theme song that, an opening credit song that had lyrics. So, all right, a little different, not your grandpa's Star Trek per se. And you're thinking, all right, well, you know, the original Star Trek song was conceived with lyrics by Alexander Courage.
Wait. Alexander Courage wrote the music. Gene Roddenberry then wrote lyrics, which he never intended to use, so that he could then get 50% of the royalties.
It's come up recently, and I had seen some of that stuff. I thought that Courage had written lyrics too.
Courage was not a happy man when he found out he was losing 50% of that.
I can only imagine he wasn't. I would not be either. So given that that had been out there at one point, you're thinking, all right, let's hear the lyrics. Maybe they really encapsulate what's going on. And then the word surfaced that it was a Diane Warren ballad called Faith of the Heart, which had actually been featured on the soundtrack to the Maudlin and Trite Robin Williams vehicle, Patch Adams, sung originally by Rod Stewart. And then people who had hair began to suddenly look like Captain Picard because they were tearing it out. And people were really, really worried. And then it debuted and there was the furor over this. And of course, you know, Rick Berman, really as keeper of the franchise flame, and Brannon Braga, who at that point had been elevated to full-fledged toady status, were the ones that received the double barrel phaser brunt of that kind of criticism. I don't think in retrospect it's terrible. The lyrics certainly fit. It's not a terrible open, but the different nature of it certainly, you know, grabbed attention at that time. That and the fact that the show took a little bit right out of the gate to get going. The pilot is very, very watchable. And again, we were 10 days to 2 weeks to maybe slightly over that after September 11th that went down and that the show premiered. Or maybe it was 02. Am I remembering this correctly, Matt? Hang on.
I'll say this while you're looking at this, looking it up. This is a point in Star Trek Essentials where certainly the Grandmaster status is certainly conferred to you. I have seen all of Classic Trek, all of the movies, all of Next Generation multiple times, Deep Space Nine all the way through. I've seen about half of Voyager, and I've seen very, very little of Star Trek Enterprise. I certainly remember watching the pilot. I don't remember it very well. I remember it kind of was like, you know, Captain Archer's gun shoots like laser blasts, or like, you know, a laser bullet, as we would see in the J.J. Abrams movies.
Right.
And I just remember quickly kind of, I remember the buzz on the show was, oh, we're so proud that it's a rugged little ship. We're so proud that you can see the beams, that if Archer stands up all the way in his ready room, he would bang his head. It's, you know, the bridge is so deep and so narrow. You know, it's deep but not wide. And I just remember being like, this is an underlit, uninteresting set. And certainly,
oh, I love the set. I really do. I just think everything's so modern and new. And granted, again, you're going with a prequel after, you know, 30 plus years of, you know, the original series. Of course it's going to look new, but I just think, you know, the move backwards was not in their best interest. And I think it's no surprise that it only, you know, lasted, and that's because, you know, the studio only let it last 4 years. That fourth season came as a result of, you know, one of the last true fan campaigns to save a show. It would have ended after that third season. And, you know, recently there's been talk of a Netflix and a Kickstarter and everything else. You know, the Blu-rays just came out, which is a quizzical move in itself, given that they went from Next Gen to Enterprise in the Blu-ray cycle, skipping, of course,
well,
Deep Space Nine and Voyager, which happened in between, which is, you know, again, kind of spurious.
Pete, I mean, as somebody who came of age during Star Trek's might in the 1990s, I'll tell you exactly why Paramount is doing that. It's the age-old, how much money can we get out of these Star Trek fans thing? You know, whether, I mean, the amount of Star Trek stuff I had back in the day, I was young enough to get years out of the figurines and the bridge set, or the bridge play set, and the transporter room play set, and the shuttle play set, and, you know, Halloween after Halloween where I was different Star Trek people, and, you know, going to my first convention when I was 16 or 17, and so on and so forth. This is just, hey, Enterprise is HD ready. We just remastered what in many ways is the crown jewel of the whole thing with Next Generation. We have already previously remastered classic Trek stuff. So I think it's just kind of like they're at the point now where like they're testing the waters slash printing their own money. Like they don't need to make any changes or at least any substantive changes to Enterprise. So just put the darn thing on Blu-ray. Then if the pile of money is enough, do you then go, all right, now we have 170 episodes of Deep Space Nine to go through. Do we want to do that? After that, do we then do Voyager? I think that's where their head is.
True. Just fact-checking before, the original air date was September 26, 2001. So on the pilot episode. But enough setup. Let's talk a little bit about this episode itself.
Yes, this episode is Shuttle Pod 1. It is the 16th episode of the first season, and in it, we witness that during a shuttle pod mission, Tucker and Reed are cut off from Enterprise and become convinced that the starship has been destroyed and that their days are numbered. And this is going to be a commentary episode, so now's a great time to pause the podcast, fire up your Netflix, grab your DVDs, grab your Blu-ray, whatever it might be, and get ready to watch along. And Pete, while people are logging into Netflix or firing up their discs, how can people get in touch with us?
They can get a hold of us in a variety of ways to share their feedback at any time. Our Twitter is at Podcast Star Trek. And then if you are a traditional type of person, you could go over to your big blocky corded telephone or maybe your slim communicator style cell phone and dial our listener line at area code 412-447-1701.
Ah, such a nice number that we have there. If you prefer email, you can send an email to StarTrekEssentials@gmail.com, and you can leave a comment on the webpage, StarTrekEssentials.blogspot.com, or you can even review us on iTunes, which of course we love. With that, Pete, should we get ready to finally get into the episode?
Absolutely.
All right, so you certainly, listeners, will be able to hear a bit of the episode volume in the background. I have the volume turned up a little bit. And here's what we're going to do, Pete, and here's what we're going to do, listeners. I have my finger on the play button. I'm going to go 3, 2, 1, 0, and on 0, we'll click play and hopefully make the magic happen here. And just a reminder, by the way, if you are on Netflix, because the way Netflix has ordered stuff, this is actually listed as episode 15 because they've combined the first two episodes.
Right.
So it's the 16th episode produced, but it's episode 15 in the Netflix number. So with that, here we go on 0, 3, 2, 1, 0. And with that, we are underway. Pete, I mean, we were just talking about the effects a second ago. These are pretty good effects.
They are.
I mean, because it's 12 years ago. They're good effects.
On the TV budget that they were working on, and certainly as the show goes on, I find their third season to really, really be excellent from an effects standpoint. The show definitely hits its stride then.
Yeah, in future seasons of Star Trek Essentials, I certainly am interested in what Enterprise episodes you'll bring, because you know, as we've talked about on the podcast before, I think, and if not, we can mention it now, there certainly have been, you know, like back in the original airing of Deep Space Nine, I was very opposed to the show, didn't enjoy it at all. And now as an adult, look back and just absolutely adore it. So I'm kind of interested to see that growth in Enterprise while we discuss it here on the podcast.
Mm-hmm.
So now, Pete, for reference for the uninitiated, I know that the episode summary said Tucker and Reed here. Which one's Tucker and which one's Reed, if you'll pardon such a silly question of mine?
Absolutely. Well, Charles Tripp Tucker is the Enterprise main engineer, chief engineer, and he is the Southern gentleman. He hails from Florida, and that's key later in the life of the series where he's from. And he is toying around right now with the systems on the shuttle pod. And Malcolm Reed, Lieutenant Malcolm Reed, is the weapons officer of the Enterprise. Very different, but two guys who they're essentially, you know, to take a duo from another Trek series. They are Miles O'Brien and Dr. Bashir of sorts.
Ah, well, certainly I know in this episode there's a little bit of both friction and friendship, so I guess that's quite a good analogy. It, I can't help but looking at some of these effect shots here as they are starting to discover the presumed final wreckage of Enterprise. The way the shuttle pod is acting certainly kind of reminiscent of the way spaceships are treated in Battlestar Galactica. But Pete, I think we have to hold that thought. We just need to breathe in the song here for a minute.
Definitely.
Turn the volume up a little bit. Get out our lighters. It definitely, I don't know. You just look at this and go, I get the concept, and it's a lovely concept. The visuals here are great.
I love the visuals.
Do we have a guitar slide coming?
I think so.
Oh, yeah, there we go. How? Why? I mean, I know these are questions that we can't exactly answer, but it's tough. It really is.
Like I said, it has grown on me, but it was groan inducing early on.
Right. Yeah, I definitely watched the pilot episode, first couple episodes, and I just remember sitting there going, what is going on? Why is there, you know?
I got out of it early in that first year. I had commitments on the night that it was running, and these were the pre-DVR days, at least in my household. And, I think I got the first couple episodes in, one in particular that comes after the pilot, which is, I think it's called Fight or Flight. It is terrible. it's really bad.
Here we are in the ready room. I don't know. You know, it's tough. There have been times, Pete, I guess I can't help but think of our Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. podcast where, you know, we've talked about how some of the earlier Marvel movies you now see through the lens of later ones and later successes. I just remember being so absolutely opposed to particularly the ready room and underlit and kind of, you know, steels and grays and that sort of thing. But now it's so reminiscent of Battlestar Galactica, and it's so reminiscent of the Deep Space Nine color palette that it's just a little bit more familiar. So it's, you know, another kind of weird anachronistic thing is how they essentially have taken the Next Generation era uniform idea, you know, of kind of something going on in the shoulders and kind of the rank in the neighborhood of the neck, you know, and they have that here, but it's now it seems kind of out of sync with where we'll see the classic Trek stuff.
It's a hodgepodge, and I get the realism, you know, a very big deal is made early on in the run of no transporters, or that they're very experimental and very dangerous. We don't have phasers yet. I think, as you mentioned before, we have phase pistols. There are no photon torpedoes. The top speed is a very low warp, and actually Enterprise is the first warp 4 or whatever, you know, number they give it at this point. Designation. So, you know, it's the Wild West, but it's the Wild West that we already know gets discovered and much safer. So,
right.
You know what I mean? It was definitely, and I get it, you know, to see the infancy of, mankind in these deeper space voyages, but at the same time, you know, we know where it goes. So I think there was very little dramatically that could be done. You know, when Enterprise works at its best in the third season and the fourth season, it is essentially a Valentine to everything that has come before.
certainly something to look forward to there. As is the presence of Jolene Blaylock on this show. It's a distinct memory I have is watching that pilot episode. Isn't there some, there's some sort of like, oh no, emergency beam up and we have bad microbes on us or we have alien goo and it's like, quick, you know, Jolene Blaylock needs to start to take off her clothes while, you know, sopping wet. Do I remember that basically correctly? And like they need to stand around for a while in decontamination or something?
Yes.
So she always holds a special place in my heart.
Those scenes continue to work on rewatch. In fact, when I watch them, they're interesting, really interesting, really interesting, not so much interesting anymore.
I guess it's an interesting bit of interestingness. I don't know, you know, it's obviously at the conclusion of the commentary, we will discuss more of, you know, what makes this essential. And certainly, you know, I mean, I've seen this episode previously in preparation for the podcast. And maybe it's unfair of me to kind of be so nitpicky, but it's like, I look at the jumpsuits and it's like, it does appear that there's a tinge of purple to them. And it just seems like a weird color choice, particularly since, for me personally, it took me a while to get used to the Next Generation movie uniforms that are, you know, black with kind of the gray shoulders that then carried over to Deep Space Nine. You know, it took me a while to get used to that, but I did get used to it. It kind of did kind of look like a little bit more of a, I don't know, big boy uniform. And here we're kind of, everybody's in like purple jumpsuits. It's just, again, maybe I'm being, Pete, am I being nitpicky?
I don't think you're being nitpicky. And again, you know, the difficulty of a prequel is we know what's going to happen, but we also know that, you know, all the gadgets and everything that's going to emerge because of that. So this kind of forced, the transporter will turn you inside out. You know, the tension's just never fully there.
I distinctly remember watching that episode when it aired. I don't know which one. Obviously, in the first couple episodes where they're like, the transporter to bring up a box of hammers? I don't know, Captain. It's like, oh, we got to embrace it. See how it is. And I think later in that episode, somebody gets beamed up and there's like bits of tree in their face or something.
Yes, that may be Fight or Flight, one I was referring to, where they beam down to a planet and essentially become really scared because of the scare particles in the atmosphere. It's really bad. Coming off of a pretty watchable, if a little long pilot, because it is a 2-hour situation.
Right.
It's a little tough early on. With the release of the Blu-ray recently, some interesting stuff emerged. If the producers had their way, they would not have launched Enterprise as a vessel until late, if not the end of the first season. They really wanted to be an earned experience. ER was very much on their minds with the nature of the arcs, the multi-episode type of arcs, which only get better and better in Enterprise, again, later in its run. But the type of thing where, you know, they wanted to, you know, have it be Earthbound for a while, which, you know, you want to talk about shaking things up and doing a different type of Star Trek. That certainly would have been more of a creative choice than, I don't know, the song.
Well, and I mean, you think back to what I think has reached its deserved reputation as the best of the Star Treks in terms of Deep Space Nine. I mean, that's a show that only truly started to have kind of an elegant setting. And not elegant to the viewer, but kind of elegant to the characters in like the second or third season. You know, particularly when they add that new theme song where it's like, hey, there, it's not just the dusty town in the middle of nowhere. It really is now the crossroads of oh so much. So, you know, how it is that Deep Space Nine was so great and so serialized and willing to do all the things that weren't the Star Trek mold, but then got made with the quote-unquote second-string people who then finished Next Generation, and then the first string people finished Next Generation, some went to the movies, other went to Voyager, finished this, and it's like, did you learn nothing from Deep Space Nine? Well, the answer is no, because as Enterprise is losing viewers throughout the four seasons, and I know you said it gets better and better as the seasons go on, but as it's losing viewers to a point that it gets canceled with 2.5 million viewers a week, at a point where the Next Generation finale had 25 million viewers, meanwhile you have Battlestar, you have Firefly, shows that maybe weren't doing much better in the ratings, but were just, can you imagine if Joss Whedon got to do Firefly mixed in with in the Star Trek universe? Can you imagine if Battlestar was after the first great Klingon war and they're on the run, that kind of aesthetic? It's a lost opportunity.
Definitely. I mean, we can look back again in retrospect and think about these things, but to evaluate them for what they are when they were, I think is truly important as well.
Yeah, and I mean, to kind of get back to this episode, we're now in a scene back on Shuttle Pod 1. I think the episode does a good job without pushing it to kind of say, hey, we have two chronologies here. We have, hey, we're going to meet them back at the asteroid. Oh, look, they're all dead. And then we have, without any kind of great, 3 days ago kind of, a flashback, dare I say it, Lost fans, but any kind of, without any great flashback flourish, it's clear, like, hey, here's Enterprise with Captain Archer checking out the damage and so on and so forth. And like pretty early on, you're realizing, hey, they're actually okay. But is this going to be two ships passing in the night where, where these guys are at risk of dying? These guys are going to die just because there's a miscommunication going on. So it certainly is a compelling, setup. It's a good episode. It really is. It's a solid episode.
And as a bottle episode, this is a function of a lot of, first season shows, particularly with a high effects budget. And, we bring up the point about the effects early on, and to contrast, the few shots we get with a lot of human drama with two guys stuck in a shuttle pod set. And, for this to be known as the fan favorite that it is, particularly amongst the first season, I think really speaks to the heart of what this show became when it hit on all cylinders.
I mean, isn't that usually the way these bottle episodes are, though, where it's just like, the best concept of a Star Trek show is lots of effects and lots of makeup and this and that, the other. And then you reach a point where you go, we got to do this on the cheap. So you go, all right. The Enterprise D is completely empty except for Picard and a bunch of bad guys. Do Die Hard on the Enterprise with a lot of low lights and, a steady cam and a director and a sound guy and Patrick Stewart and run around in the shadows. And it's brilliant. Or this, as you said, a beloved episode from the first season, because you say to the writers and you say to these two actors, find the human drama here. The shot I'm looking at this exact moment where you can see over his shoulder, you can see the shuttle pod window, it's black cloth with shiny gems on it. It's not even moving. You don't even have a guy running the hand crank to make it look like they're moving. It's about these two guys saying, hey, Trip is trying to, is trying to push off the fact that he's going to die, and Reed is there saying, I want to do all my perfect, final letters to all my loves, so I can kind of put the exclamation point at the end of my life. It's absolutely compelling. It's good stuff.
It is, and it builds the rapport between these two characters at a time in the series, 16 episodes in, where you're really starting to establish no longer character, but relationships.
Now, this is a fun fake out here where you go to commercial, you come back, and, oh, they've been rescued. They're okay. And you go, oh, yeah, well, of course I knew they were going to be rescued. Like, duh, they're not going to kill off two people. This isn't, Denise Crosby here. It certainly is a it's a nice fake out, particularly what we're heading to right here, which is some good stuff indeed. An enjoyable scene ahead of us to be sure. So, Pete, do I recall correctly that our favorite female first officer here, although some people might put, you know, the original number one ahead of her, not me though. It was her presence was kind of very much kind of picking up the. It was a continuation of, hey, the Vulcans are the ones that initiated first contact, and there was kind of the intent was to be a little bit of a through line there.
Well, the Vulcans are really set up in the early going of this show as an impediment to, it's not even Starfleet yet. You know, it's an evolving type of thing. And, you know, that's the kind of drama that they talked about teasing out over the course of that first season. If they had done that, that it would be constantly pushing the Vulcans. We got to get to space. We got to get to space. We got to get to space. And the Vulcans saying, Hey, hang on now. And I believe it's established in the pilot. It's been 75 years since first contact, or whatever the number is.
Right.
And it's like, really? Wouldn't we be further down the road by now? But they really made them earn it. And I think the execs were right in that, you know, while I applaud the boldness that, you know, wow, you would have had a show about, you know, deep space that for a first season would have stayed on Earth. And I would really like to see that.
Yeah.
You know, I think the premise would have folded in upon itself. Wait, where's this Enterprise? What Enterprise are they going on already? Can they get underway with their Enterprise? It would have been too difficult a balance for a franchise in particular that was running out of steam.
Yes, the franchise was running out of steam. And I know that the day that Enterprise was canceled, Ron Moore wrote a blog post entitled, still sticks with me after all these years, entitled Star Trek finally returns to the fans, or something close to that. And his notion basically being Paramount doesn't own Star Trek. I mean, it owns Star Trek, but Paramount doesn't really own Star Trek. Star Trek is owned by the fans. You know, in the 70s, the fans kept it alive with fiction and with the conventions, and that you know, just as the field must return to nature occasionally to be renewed, so too must Star Trek. And yes, this was a series that was, I think, you know, it was being mismanaged, or, you know, by the studio, by the network, by those concerns. I'll disagree with you, Pete. I mean, look, you can't get around the fact that you're doing a preview, a prequel episode, pardon me, a prequel series, and that you know where things are going to end up. I agree that's a dramatic concern, a dramatic problem. That said, if you're going to commit to it, I mean, how great would it be to be, especially if, you know, I was into the whole kind of, you know, technical end of Next Generation, you know, bought the technical manual and read through it and leafed through it and all that. I think it would have just been a ton of fun to be like, you know, hey, this is where we're going to put the captain's chair soon. And you see that, you know, six episodes later to finally launch, you know, in episode 20 or episode 24 and go, I mean, look, it's so suitable now. We're kind of so serialized now that it just feels natural. But I think I can understand the network resistance then. You know, wrong time, wrong place. I don't know. I mean, to kind of do a Adventure of the Week in 2001 sounded like a good idea in 2001. Then, you know, Battlestar starts to change that. Lost starts to change that. Even, you know, some of your soapier stuff like Desperate Housewives and, you know, other shows like that. Grey's Anatomy start to say, you need to tune in every week and you need to keep track because this has ups and downs and lefts and rights. So
Star Trek's always been very slow to change, though. And the irony that it's a show that is so different from what is typically on TV, you know, when they fell into, you think there are essentially, you know, 500 hours of TV between what had been done with the original series and then the other spinoffs before you get to Enterprise. So, you know, while they did get into multiple episode arcs in both Deep Space Nine and then in Voyager, they were still fighting the battle of trying to justify those. So when you get a season-long arc in season three of Enterprise, that was truly revolutionary. But again, none of that happens without the critical success of an episode like this about two characters who, not yet friends, think they're going to freeze to death and die.
And just to clarify, when you said 500 hours, you mean Next Generation, Deep Space Nine, and Voyager, right?
Yes, the interim.
So it's that. It took me a second to catch on there that this crew of people, this Star Trek production, this Paramount regime, et cetera. Yeah, these people have already done 500 episodes. I mean, it's an argument for new blood. It's an argument for not pissing off Ron Moore and having him, you know, go do G versus Z on USA, and then like maybe he'll dust off some other sci-fi thing. You know, it's a shame because, you know, to truly bring it back to this episode, you know, we had the scene before the commercial break where they're using the mashed potatoes to fix the little micro fissures in the hull, and they've kind of had their yelling moment, and now they're kind of calming down a bit. We have Reed here now about to start to shave himself in the finest British fashion of always looking your best, always being at ship-shape condition, even 18 hours away from your very calculatable doom. This is an episode that's working. It's an episode that's working in a formula that isn't. So. That's a nice little hook there, you know. You're shaving, but you're going to die, and your beard is going to continue to grow.
Which is actually not true.
Really?
It's not. It's a fallacy.
Well, you know.
Same with fingernails.
He is a Florida man, after all.
Although voiding yourself does happen.
Well, that's good, I guess.
In a vacuum of space. It'll float around.
This is true. This is true. So, I'm always... This scene here with Archer and T'Pol, I don't know. I never watched much of Quantum Leap, but I always feel like, you know, he's always going to be the guy from Quantum Leap. He's always going to be trying to get home.
I know he took this endeavor very, very seriously, and any story you ever hear connected to this show about him is nothing but magnanimous. And he had a tradition where he shook the hand of every person on the set every day he filmed.
Wow.
You know, but yeah, there's fighting out from you're far more recognized in that other role. To the point where, Matt, we have seen him and the other captains, sans the current captain, Christopher
Pine. You wouldn't say Christopher Pike, didn't you?
It's tough. Beep, it's a tough beep. One sometimes. Yeah, I would beep twice for no. to see them, and you know, he gets a lot of fans who come to see him for Quantum Leap. You know, oh, you were in Star Trek, but let's talk about Did You Ever Get Home or whatever the heck, you know. So I think that was tough, and you know. Not done a ton of research, trying to remember back in the day, like who were the other choices they bandied around or whatever. And, you know, the decision was obviously made. We want to go with you know, that strong male presence. We want to go with somebody who's got the chops. You know, they had learned after Voyager, oh, we botched that one at first. And, you know, that captain position is not taken lightly. And obviously you've got to want the chair as much as the chair wants you.
Right. I know you said kind of that, you know, traditional guy. I just feel like his performance of Archer and kind of perhaps just the persona that he puts forth acting in general, he's kind of so congenial that I almost have a hard time believing he could, you know, dress down a junior or a senior officer who needs it, you know, that he could kind of deliver tough love. You know, I'm sure there's episodes where he does, don't get me wrong, but I don't know. He's just, again, you certainly are the master concerning these Enterprise episodes, and it seems like you have more confidence in him with the more episodes that you've seen. I'll certainly defer to you.
He's a good captain. He is. Trip was the breakout actor and character on this version of Star Trek. You know, he gets featured very early and then the character takes off. T'Pol again as the eye candy, and then, you know, Lieutenant Laredo, the helmsman of I'm mixing my Galaxy Quest in there, but Anthony Montgomery is essentially Lieutenant Laredo. you know, they get their couple things, you know, and Hoshi, you know, shows up once in a while, but it did very much become the Trip to Paul Archer show in the spirit of the old triumvirate of, you know, Kirk, Spock, and McCoy. But, you know, the swagger, the accent, the everyman, you know, that's what Trip brought. And, you know, certainly came with some controversy at the end of the show when they decided, you know, we'll kill the character off in the finale and then completely dishonor the memory of the show itself and make the entire thing a holodeck simulation that Riker and Troy are having.
Yeah, I mean, the poor Enterprise that had to fight for life for all 4 years. I mean,
their finale becomes a franchise finale, which I think is a difficult way to get at it.
Yeah, but as you say, you know, whether you have 25 million viewers or 2.5 million viewers, people loved the show, whatever number there was, and to do that final episode, that infamous final episode where you say, we're actually not giving you a finale because, you know, we, the production crew, we need our finale. It's just, you know, hey, I'm just tuning in to Enterprise to have a good time, and I can revisit, you know, your production past with, like, my whole VHS tape collection there. You know, like, the need to do all that is, I don't know, it was just not the way to go.
And, you know, speaking here, Tripp's just been talking about Obituary. You know, I think that left a bad taste. And I know that that's been talked about, you know, since the shelving of the show, you know, that's what the producers regret the most was making it, you know, a Star Trek finale rather than an Enterprise finale. It's interesting to note that the two episodes right before the finale feature Peter Weller, feature RoboCop, in a bad guy role. And when he got the role in the most recent Star Trek film, Star Trek Into Darkness, there was a lot of, wow, is he going to play the same guy?
Right. And that's obviously not the case, given the... Well, given he's not playing Admiral Marcus, I assume.
He's not. But when he was originally cast, they said he was playing a businessman. And what had Weller played in those two episodes? A businessman. So instantly people were like, oh, man. And look, you know, that's where, you know, as keepers, current keepers of the franchise flame, you know, Abrams and Orky and Kurtzman and Lindelof have honored what's come before. You know, they make references to Admiral Archer's prized Beagle and, you know, things along that line in order to, you know, touch on all points of the franchise. But Enterprise never truly got the full opportunity, I think, to stand on their own.
By the way, the scene that we're in now, probably an easy production decision, but not an easy one to live through. You can actually see their breath. I'm assuming that's not, they're not going to the trouble of doing it computer generated. I'm assuming they just kind of, you know, maybe put a tarp around the set. I mean, this is obviously a set that you can kind of snap together, you know, so it's enclosed. Pumped in some, you know, air conditioning in there to actually get that. So I'm assuming you have actually cold actors who are trying to keep warm. You know, it's probably iced tea in the bottle there, but it's a nice touch. It really is.
Netflix not having the extras like DVD and Blu-ray can offer us breath, but I could be wrong. It's been a while since I watched that.
Fair enough. Digital breath then. Well, I stand corrected. So I guess it was an easy production decision. Hey, boys, keep doing what you've been doing. We're going to have the guys paint some stuff in later on for your cold breath. So fair enough. So here now we definitely have kind of rounding into the middle of the fourth act. We have the prospect of hope coming to us. On the reference of a desert island at a Lost at Sea movie, definitely making me think of another TV series that aired a few years after this one. Now, Pete, I have to ask, and maybe, again, is this me standing, you know, from the point of view of myself at my teens, high on Next Generation, the ball caps. Is it a marketing move? It's a weird cut to the cap. It almost looks kind of like Civil War-esque.
It's not, and I'm going to tell you why I know that. I have tried to purchase a cap like that, and they don't make it.
Wow.
So it was not, I want to say it was like a cast and crew thing, and they thought, you know what, this works in the day and age that we're doing, and we're just going to go with it.
I don't know that I necessarily agree with that decision, but I guess I'm not producing Star Trek for a reason.
You know, they wear it very early on in the pilot. Archer has one on in a shuttle pod as they're looking over the Enterprise before they launch it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of done with a, oh, all right, you know, like you're on the crew and you've got the crew's or you've got the ship's registry number on your ball cap. Okay. And then you see them don them, you know, early on in the series. They go away. You know, I think it's kind of it's a decent nod. And again, you know, we're retconning so many of the things that we knew, you know, the idea of, you know, ball caps on Kirk's Enterprise is heresy.
Absolutely. It is. I don't know. I understand where they're coming from is it makes sense. But then that's, you know, that's part of the tension of Enterprise, which is kind of being like, you know what, Kirk's PDA that, you know, he'd have to sign, that was great back in the 60s, but now we have stuff that's better than that in the year 2000, so we have to update it. It's just kind of like, you know, I know that there have been various discussions, let's say in the 90s for, you know, do you reboot James Bond back into the 60s? Like, what do you do? And obviously they, you know, have decided to keep it modern. Do you somehow, like, would Enterprise have been a better show if you just committed to, we're doing the voyages of Captain Robert April and kind of do it as a complete nostalgia thing where it's the classic Trek set, maybe spruced up, maybe ready for HD, maybe with some of those, you know, the blurry
not blurry, but the, you know, like the blinky screens and whatnot, just a little updated, and go, guys, there's not moving screens in the background of this box console, but there's going to be moving screens in the background of you know, on this, and just kind of deal with it. I don't know.
I think the aesthetic really came last. You know, the decision, they were for some reason fixated on doing a prequel, though. And, you know, Star Trek, though there's a lot of time travel throughout, you know, the 700 hours of Star Trek, okay? Star Trek at its best has always been looking forward. And it's the idea here that, you know, this show, again, the love letter that it is to the original series and nods to, you know, the other series is throughout, you know, that they get into, particularly in those last 2 years, it needed to go forward. And therein is the compromise with the whole temporal Cold War and all that stuff. And Braga went on the record lately as saying that was the biggest encumbrance in what they dealt with as far as writing this series. The first two season, you know, dalliance with the temporal Cold War and Future Guy, as he's, you know, dubbed by the fans, who at one point there was talk it might be Kirk, it could be somebody else. It's never answered. It hangs out there, and just another reason that, you know, that was another executive saying, well, you're going to do a prequel, but you're going to have something from, you know, past where we were in Trek.
Yeah. I mean, it certainly speaks to the bold and I think rather elegant decision made for the J.J. Abrams movies, where you get to simultaneously keep everything that you had before it and completely wash it away with that decision to, you know, to send Nero back in time. So now you get all the blinky screens and all the iPhone influenced design that you want on the bridge. You get to have a completely modern looking Enterprise, you know, modern to our eyes in the 21st century. You get to have that because, man, these guys, they got a view in the future from 100 years in the future, and that's completely changed technology, and it's completely changed arms races and so on and so forth. You know, it's really a great solution.
I dare say, Matt, you have better brains guarding the franchise now than you did then.
Yeah. I mean, I remember seeing Star Trek Generations with my uncle opening weekend, and he's, you know, he's somebody who watched Classic Trek when it aired, and him just looking at me when Kirk died and just this look of, he just shot daggers out of his eyes. And I remember him saying that weekend he went home and started taping over his Next Generation VHS tapes, you know, that he had taped off TV. Was I as upset about it? No, but you know what? I hadn't lived with the character for over 25 years. Was that the right choice? Was having Spock show up in that two-parter episode, I want to say Redemption, that's not it. But, the, you know, Spock on Romulus and him saying, oh, enough of this cowboy diplomacy, let's grow up. You know, we have to do things differently. And you're going, you just took a slam at 6 movies and 70 episodes? How does that make sense? It's a weird relationship that Rick Berman and that crew has with the franchise. And I think, as you said before, the current Keepers of the Flame certainly have an understanding that they need to work really hard to do their own thing while respecting what has come before them.
And it's a challenge. And that's why, again, I feel that, you know, Star Trek belongs first and foremost on the TV. As big a fans of the movies as I am, I came to them first. But it needs to be on TV, and it needs to be set past any old ties we have to it. You know, throw us 250 years down the road and let it start up. Then you can always honor what came before and talk about Kirk and Picard and Sisko and Janeway and Archer, but you free yourself up for new, fresh stories.
back when the J.J. Abrams, you know, Star Trek had come out, the first one, it was my hope that they might decide to do like a Kelvin TV show. Mm-hmm. Just because I felt like then you're not stepping on the toes. A, you get to kind of be prequel-y to the movies. So you kind of get to stay out of the way of whatever you might want to be concerned about there. You also kind of get to be a little bit, I don't want to say cheesy, but it's like, you know, you're not interacting much with the Klingons. You're not really into, you know, it's kind of like a slightly smaller universe that Kirk is born into. I wish they had gone that route. Obviously, they didn't. You know, it could have been, obviously, you know, several years before the Kelvin is destroyed. So,
right.
Anyhow, Pete, here we're indeed back in sick bay again. I think, could we call this the stinky reprise?
With the spray on facial hair.
Is it off to look? I mean, I'm watching it on a pretty good TV. Is it not up to snuff? I think
that would seem to be spray on facial hair. It doesn't.
Okay, yeah.
It doesn't look rooted.
I think some of the scenes in their moments of desperation, I think might have been actually real beard, particularly on Trip. But right. I see a little up against the profile of the pillow there. I see some hair sticking out, although I don't know. Is spray on just kind of like,
oh, they have it's a whole system. They used it on Lost. They used it on other shows as well.
Well, it's certainly, I don't know. Trip's beard definitely looks legit to me, but I guess who can tell? Well, that Pete, the episode starts to wrap up. Sleep well, my friend. The camera cranes up. All are happy and good to go. And we start to delve into the instrumental version of the theme. So, Pete, what is it about this episode that, in your mind, you as the Enterprise expert, what is it that makes this episode an essential? Why did you choose this? And me, in my ignorance of Enterprise, say, sure thing, Pete, sounds good.
It's the pairing of the friends. Star Trek at its heart, for, you know, the want of the exploration has always been about the exploration of the human heart. And, you know, those places we find within us when tested. And to have two guys who aren't friends get stranded, think they're going to die, think they've lost their entire crew, and to really, you know, sow the seeds of a very strong friendship made this an easy choice.
And, you know, it does speak as well to, you know, I think that the strongest parts of the Star Trek franchise, which is when you can, I won't quite say go serial, but when you can show character growth, you know, Star Trek 2 to 3 to 4, though, you know, that kind of, and then to kind of tack on 6 in there, there's a through line in many, many ways. Not even in many, many ways. I mean, there's an obvious through line with the Spock stuff. There's an obvious through line with, you know, I've never trusted Klingons. I never will. I can't forgive them for the death of my boy. And we like characters dealing with consequences. The notion that Classic Trek was, all standalone episodes, that it was essentially an anthology with familiar characters each week, was novel at the time. But to see an episode like Shuttlepod 1 where there is growth in the characters, and to end on that, you know, that quite note, sleep well, my friend, that quite nice note, it's it does speak to the best of Star Trek indeed.
In a first season in particular, where, you know, we're getting into the strangeness of space and going down to planets for the first time, and mankind is out there, you know, apart from the logistics of having to go to a bottle episode because we're doing all these, you know, strange setups, it was logical just in terms of slowing the pace down and really bringing it back to a relationship-centric type of story.
That's what it's all about, man. Well, with that, Pete, before we take a quick look towards next week's episode, I know what a fan favorite you are, Pete. The fan mail rolls in. What is your personal Twitter? People want to be able to interact with you on a synchronous basis.
Absolutely. You can find me on Twitter at Peter, P-I-E-T-E-R, J, Ketelaar, K-E-T-E-L-A-A-R.
And I'm on Twitter as Looking Back Lost. And looking ahead to next week, I will be flying solo on that one as I discuss the Voyager episode, Eye of the Needle. If you want to watch it ahead of time, that is the 7th episode from the first season. And after that, Pete, you'll be back in 2 weeks' time for us to conclude our first season of Star Trek Essentials, talking the first Star Trek movie in the, I guess you could call it the overall chronology, that the J.J. Abrams Star Trek, which certainly should be exciting indeed.
Looking forward to it.
Yeah, that'll just be not a commentary track episode, kind of a discussion type episode. And with that, you know, after 2 weeks' time, we'll go on a brief hiatus and return with season 2 of Star Trek Essentials sometime in the winter. So I guess with that, Pete, thank you for selecting such a heartfelt episode. And it's such a popular thing, Pete. I will say adios to everybody, and you can give us your famous final word.
I don't want to die alone.